architect Avani Parekh.
The topic for the day is the architectures of postmodernism. And the idea was to try and create a spectrum of ideas in architecture that have come out of postmodernism, so that at the end, we might be able to get some idea as to why the concept of postmodernism is so vague, not only in architecture but in all the arts. Several simultaneous debates and developments have occurred in the field. And one idea was to try and understand these in some way, so that you could place different positions and be able to devise strategies if you were interested in actually developing a certain type of practice. There are many debates implied by and implicated in the term postmodernism. The work of architects I will look at represents a spectrum of ideas on postmodernism. That is, it is possible to discuss their work as representing one of three theoretical developments in postmodernism. Each of these can be seen to provide a fundamentally different kind of response to postmodernism, an aesthetic one, a philosophical one, and a cultural response to the nature of postmodernity. I think it's the development of these three strands that has actually made the concept so vague. Inquiry into the aesthetic character of the postmodern was begun at that point in the late 1960s, when the virtue and authority of modernism first came under sustained examination within the actual practice of modern architecture. And what Timothy showed us this morning as to the first developments of Kitai and people trying to reclaim certain things from modernism and trying to expand it, I feel belongs to this category of architecture. Architects too made similar types of responses. As an aesthetic response, postmodern architecture saw itself essentially reclaiming certain areas rejected by the modern movement. It constructed various dichotomies against what the modern movement had sort of laid down as certain tenets. Things like formalism versus functionalism. The first of these are the new tenets that postmodernism came up with, like formalism, and functionalism is what modernism had reduced things to. Color versus white, surface versus depth, populism versus elitism, heterotopia versus utopia, relativism versus moralism, plenitude versus minimalism, representation versus abstraction, pastiche versus an earnestness in modernism, play versus earnestness, subjectivity versus objectivity, fragmentation versus totality, language and meanings versus technique, contamination versus autonomy, a gender model of female versus male, weak form versus strong form. This aesthetic response was in large part triggered by the publication of two books, Aldo Rossi's The Architecture of the City and Robert Venturi's book Complexity and Contradiction in Architecture. The next stage, the explicit theorization of the postmodern, was a concern of the late 70s and 80s. This was the time that theory got codified, and one saw the ascendancy and privileging of theory in architectural practice. As a philosophical response, it saw as its project the taking apart of all these formal dichotomies through various tactics it generated, so that all the these dichotomies that I just laid out, like color versus white, the next stage, which was more theoretical, tried to take these apart because of various reasons that I will cover as we go along. At this stage, the relation between theory and practice changed significantly as a debate was generated between the followers of Habermas and critical theory versus Derrida, Foucault, and post-structuralism and their followers in architecture. Now, the German-French axis took prominence in shaping architectural practice, vis-à-vis the American focus in the 60s. As each position evolved, each group accused the other of being conservative and saw itself as being radical. The third development in the concept of postmodernism grew on the ground of substantial historical change that involved the feeling amongst various cultural critics that the socio-economic conditions had changed so significantly that new artistic and cultural forms were in order. This response evolved into the debate on the nature of postmodernity versus modernity. Postmodernity was seen and involved a new cultural milieu. It was seen in different guises as either the post-industrial age, the information age, the age of multiculturalism, the new consumer society. All these implied a new postmodernism in architecture. Many of those preoccupied with this theme started with the assumption that modernism typically referred to a culture that was Western in its orientation, capitalist in its determining economy, white in its racial complexion, and masculine in its dominant gender. For those reacting to these issues, to talk of a postmodern culture or of postmodern forms of architecture was very often to talk of forms in opposition to hegemony. Not that it necessarily was a critical position. People like Daniel Bell also wrote about the post-industrial society and came up with certain types of responses. But people like Edward Said, Frederick Jameson, Andreas Husson, Deleuze, David Harvey can be said to have shaped the debate from this third standpoint of cultural criticism. I'd like to take each one of these positions up a little more in detail just to see what they came up with and what types of strategies each one of them evolved. The first one, the aesthetic response. The aesthetic reaction in architecture, I'd like to first two slides, please, can be seen quite effectively in the work of two architects turned theorists, Robert Venturi and Aldo Rossi. The strategy employed by each of them effectively broke the stranglehold of functionalist thought in architecture. All this time, it was always thought that architecture form had to follow function, and these were the first two attempts. The building on the left is what Robert Venturi tried to promote. It's a building by Michael Graves, but it was the best slide I could find, and the building on the your left is Aldo Rossi. And the two are very different positions, but they were aesthetic responses. They felt that modernism was limited in certain ways, it had a certain box-like character, it had reduced itself to a certain minimalism, and so they started coming up with certain aesthetic strategies to counter that. What was seminal in both Rossi's and Venturi's work was a shock factor in validating what modernism had rejected. Venturi's shock strategy involved the validation of a popular culture inspired by things like Las Vegas and Main Street in the US that resulted in a pop architecture in which high architecture emulated low. In his architecture, he claimed to introduce elements that contradicted all that pure modernism had sanctified. In his own words, he said, and this refers to the building on the left, "I prefer elements that are hybrid rather than pure, compromising rather than clean, distorted rather than straightforward, ambiguous rather than articulated, boring as well as interesting, conventional rather than designed." Drawing loosely on Anglo-American modernist literary criticism, Venturi's strategy was to ironically flip into a populist polemic an argument that had been used to defend modern architecture's complexity and elitism earlier. He suggested that the artistic signs of the postmodern are to be recognized in works which abjure all pretense to spontaneity and directness of expression, making use instead of pastiche and discontinuity. Rossi, too, the building on the left, was hugely influential in breaking the stranglehold of functionalist thought. His shock strategy took a different turn as it searched for a new relationship between architecture and the city. Earlier, the architecture was always an object aside from the city. It was the result of the singular artist who was creating, just like, you know, in the masterful artist, the original artist creating an object in space. Rossi went against that and talked about drawing from the city in order to be able to develop various forms as an artistic device. Architecture is not a new form of art, but a critical redirection of tradition on the basis of a revised understanding of the immediate past. His preoccupation was with primary forms, simplified to the extreme but suffused with dramatic tensions by drawing upon the fragmented unconscious of collective form. He used various ideas, various devices from the Italian cities and created a certain type of development against modern architecture on that basis. This was the very early stages of postmodernism. Postmodernism till this time was not viewed among architects as a critical category, but rather as a polemical movement with stylistic and social implications. Specifically, this movement included those currents that endorsed the use of historical styles and imagery. A lot of the architecture coming out of architects today, the mandala, the ideas of Vistar, the developments at the Indira Gandhi Research Center, Charles Correia's Bharat Bhopal, a lot of this comes out of this early movement of taking modernism forward. It also emphasizes the scenographic and decorative properties of architecture. Although the group of practitioners that stepped into the philosophical debate on postmodernism were also very highly critical of aspects of modern architecture, they felt uncomfortable with the solutions prescribed. Not only did many postmodern designs seem formally regressive and nostalgic for a lost past, but they also appeared to relate to the conservative turn of contemporary politics. The flamboyant gestures geared toward the imperialist imagery of public structures, luxury hotels, like this one, which is a Walt Disney hotel, popular, all this sounded more paternalistic and than democratic. And they felt that all it was doing was, they had little interest in challenging the existing power structures in society. So the philosophical group of practitioners felt that these early approaches, what they shared was a synchronic viewpoint which disregarded changes in the ideology itself. The European typological studies, which is Aldo Rossi and his group, even though the two are very distinct, one is very purist, very formalist, actually went down to finding out some of the typologies and morphologies of urban form. They felt it still was very static as a response, and it didn't really question what the new issues emerging were. In the face of such developments, they felt the need to examine more seriously the relationship between architecture and the ideology that exists in relation to economic and social structures at large. It is against this background that I will look at the works of Kenneth Frampton and the deconstructivists Peter Eisenman, Bernard Schumi, Daniel Libeskind, and others. Okay, I'd like the next two slides, please. Two different streams of thought developed at this point because there was the German and the French axis. I'm going to take the German axis first, the issues of the interest of Kenneth Frampton and the ideas of Habermas and the Frankfurt School. Yeah. And this is the images coming out of what he prescribes as a turn of mind. The position Kenneth Frampton envisages is one of a critical regionalism. Like the critical theory of the Frankfurt School, he calls his philosophy or his theory in architecture critical regionalism. Frampton's aim is to have an architecture that has an emancipatory role. Critical theory aims at freeing people from coercion that is in part self-imposed. It is a form of knowledge, where the aim, simply put, is to produce enlightenment in people who hold this theory. For Habermas, a strong source of aesthetic resistance remains necessary as a counter to the increasing power of economic and administrative systems. And he feels that the aesthetics or the art plays that role in any society, and it must have a certain resistive role. Frampton, too, operates in a similar way. For Frampton, the marginal practices are what develop the emancipatory, liberative features of architecture. He feels that it is not the architecture that comes out of late capitalism, out of what its centers were, that creates or allows for such an emancipatory architecture, but only architecture which develops in sporadic, marginal, regional ways. These are the pockets of resistance in the field of architecture which rise against the power of Anglo-American hegemony.
this is the architecture that comes out of the peripheries. And the types of characteristics that define such an architecture are climate, topography, light, construction practices, craft practices, myths. All these play a role in creating such an architecture. For Frampton, unlike other arts, architecture is embedded in the life world. It is for this reason that one may talk of architecture being experienced by the entire body, or rather the whole being. Hence, it is critically possible to address the field of architecture in terms of its tactile potential, rather than just the primacy increasingly given to the visual by Venturi and others. This is the more sensitive, liberative, and critical architecture because of its resistance to universalization and the rule of an optimized applied technology. And what he means by this is that each region has certain constraints, certain limitations in terms of its technology, climate, light. And so he gives an ideal medieval town. And the type of section, the type of architecture he begins to look at is the way it's experienced from the inside in a more tactile way, not just visual. So he doesn't have in his philosophy just pictures of surfaces of buildings, but he looks at how they're shaped inside, how their construction shapes them, and how people feel more in a more tactile way. And he feels that only the types of architectures that's a section of a building that emerges with using a more local base, not just using materials which are internationally available, but responding much more to what's immediately available around you, can create an architecture of resistance. It can make a statement against this wider technology. Okay, the next slide, please. I'm going to move on to deconstructivist architecture, and that these are some of the images. This is the most dominant stream in academia. In the leading practitioners of the world are mostly influenced by the ideas of post-structuralism, by French theory, and by the ideas of Jacques Derrida. It's a very confusing area, and I will try and talk about why this confusion often occurs. To the left is Bernard Schumi. To the right is Peter Eisenman. I'm going to explain what Jacques Derrida's ideas briefly were and why deconstructivist architecture comes up with architecture of this type. Jacques Derrida's ideas have come to play an important part in architectural discussion, and this is due to a growing awareness of the aporias into which modernism, with its rational construction of logic, progress, totality, has brought our civilization. Peter Eisenman and Bernard Schumi are two of the leading practitioners whose work aims to stir up a modernism that has become all too quiet and static, and to break open fundamentals and fundamentalisms with architectural methods. These architects have subjected their métier to the same kind of examination that Derrida applied to textual matter. What Derrida calls deconstruction is a strategy, it's a way of reading philosophical or literary texts in order to get to the bottom of them. Deconstruction involves burrowing deep to find out what unconscious premises a text is based on and what are some of the blind spots in it, and try to uncover them. Deconstruction does not attack the existing structures from the outside. It can only achieve something if it resides within the system. So basically, what deconstruction would do is, if it wanted to act upon painting, it would have to act through the medium of painting. It would find it very hard to go outside the medium of painting to make a comment on painting. And similarly with architecture, it feels that it had to reside within modernism if it wanted to make a statement on modernism. It necessarily has to operate from inside to make use of all the subversive strategic tools within the old structure, and then overturn, break open, deconstruct. Bernard Schumi is concerned with the theme of transgression in relation to architecture. Both Peter Eisenman and Bernard Schumi, they're interested in what the limitations are in terms of what what philosophies we have available today, the ideas of a totality, the ideas of rationality. They want to look at some of the things that, some of the issues that were not prominent in earlier times. So decentralization, disjunction, juxtaposition, heterogeneity, fragmentation are cornerstones of Shumi's approach. Peter Eisenman is concerned with also the loss of the central position, the eccentricity of man in the modern age. For architecture, he translates this, and he feels that there is no longer anything it can relate to, neither to man as the measure of all things, nor to such self-created fictions as reason or history. So Eisenman's strategy is to decompose and demystify the truths and gospels which architecture embraced and unquestioningly accepted. To do that means to displace the conditions of architecture as they used to be. In other words, the condition that saw architecture as reasonable, as understandable, as clearly functioning, this displacement does not mean all these ideas that were earlier defined right through the times of Vitruvius, that architecture must have utility, firmness, and beauty. Eisenman would say that these are all things that, these are the tenets that would have to be questioned. You can't move outside it. You take Vitruvius himself, you take some of the classical modes of doing architecture, and you examine them from the inside. So he believes that when Vitruvius said that a building had to have utility, firmness, beauty, what Eisenman is suggesting is that yes, a building has to function, but it does not have to look like it functions. Yes, a building has to stand up, but it does not have to look like it stands up. And when it does not look like it stands up, or it does not look like it functions, then it functions and stands differently. And it makes people question, it makes people think, and it creates a certain critical edge to the viewer, to the viewer's experience. Both Shumi and Eisenman are working to disencumber architecture of a too limited scientific technical rationality. Architecture has always been a central institution valued above all for its provision of stability and order. Buildings are constructed by taking simple geometric forms, cubes, cylinders, spheres, cones, and so on, and combining them into stable ensemblers. The projects of these architects mark a different sensibility, one in which pure form has been disturbed. It is the ability to disturb our thinking about form that makes these projects deconstructive. Can we go on to the next two, please? However, there's a certain distinction between what is deconstructive architecture in the form of using ideas of Derrida and just fragmenting a building, slicing it, splitting it. The building on my left is a building by Frank Gehry, and it shows a very, it's impure, it's skewed, it has, you know, it's a geometric composition which seems quite radical in many ways. And still, there's a certain distinction between what Bernard Shumi and Eisenman are doing and what Frank Gehry is doing. While these projects are formidable, they do not follow the philosophy of Derrida. What they do is they remain simulations of deconstructive work in other disciplines because they do not exploit the unique condition of the architectural object. Deconstruction is not dissimulation or demolition or fracturing or slicing a structure. That's not what deconstruction is. It's the challenging of the very values of harmony, unity, stability in a way that is intrinsic to the architecture. Irregular geometry is understood as a structural condition rather than a formal aesthetic. The building on the left makes formal moves on a piece of work, but that is not intrinsic to the architecture. It is not produced simply by the conflict of pure forms. It is now produced within those forms. Deconstruction has to work from within. The forms themselves are infiltrated with the characteristic skewed geometry and distorted. In this way, the traditional condition of the architectural object is radically disturbed. Unlike Gehry, this disturbance does not result from external violence. It is not a fracturing, a fragmentation or piercing. To disturb a form from the outside in these ways is not to threaten that form, only to damage it. The damage produces a decorative effect, an aesthetic of danger, an almost picturesque representation of peril, but not a tangible threat. Instead, Eisenman and Shumi's architecture aims to disturb figures from within. This doesn't mean that contorted geometry has become some new kind of interior decoration. The internal disturbance has actually been incorporated into the internal structure, the construction. It is as if some kind of parasite has infected the form and distorted it from within. The difference between external fracturing and internal disturbance is the difference between formal displacement and conceptual deconstruction. Eisenman's exhibition, and I'd like to go on to some of the next slides, run through them very quickly. This was an exhibition designed by Eisenman on his own work, and it was created as an installation. This is a very clear example, because what he did, it was at the Canadian Center for the Arts, and what he did was to construct the entire exhibit like an installation, where his own projects and models, which were supposed to be the main things exhibited, took on a marginal role. So he starts displacing the ideas of what a museum is and what it's supposed to be exhibiting, and he reverses the role so that the container, what's going to contain all his exhibits, becomes the work itself. The way he begins to work with the architectural object is he'll start working structurally with it, start displacing with it, and seeing what happens to the forms when he works with it in an internal way. So he'll shift the coordinates, x, y, z coordinates in various ways, and he'll start trying to look at what happens to the structure from within, in what way it changes, and he builds it along those lines. Let's go on. That's the plan, the gallery plan, and these are just some of his 11 of his projects in different wings. As you can see, you know, the walls often tilt, the soffits don't line up, and these are some of the ideas that he feels begin to displace the viewer. There's no central perspective, you don't know exactly where you are because the Greek cross plan that we saw earlier gets distorted, and so some of the basic assumptions of modern architecture are questioned by the viewer. The viewer begins to wonder what is happening, but he can still make sense of it. It's still architecture, it's still not so different. He's still working with the same elements that modern architecture came up with, but he's working from them, working at them from within. Okay, we go on. This is the rest of the installation, just the way it's exhibited. Yes, next. Okay, that's Eisenman. I wanted to just briefly take up the third position, which is the cultural response. Can I have the lights, please? At issue under this third theme is the question of the continuity of our culture and our values. There's a whole group of cultural critics today who feel that all the values that society used to have, all the beliefs that we used to have broken apart. There's no continuity. We don't know whether these values still pervade. There's so much pluralism. There are so many different positions, and it's really hard to create a certain forum for communication, which can create harmony, which can actually create a certain totality, I guess, in that sense. So the question for these people is, on what grounds should we now examine, criticize, and compare appeals for continuity of values and institutions on the one hand, and appeals for radical change on the other? For the architects and critics in this group, the strategies of critical regionalism and deconstruction pale in significance to certain prior questions, because if you're questioning everything, if you can't even converse, if you don't have any common goals, or common ground on which to stand, how can you even deconstruct something or, you know, have a certain critical regionalism, because it assumes a certain common understanding of architecture or art. This group of theorists participating in this debate range from conservatives like Daniel Bell to feminists, multiculturalists, right-wing and left-wing critics. If different writers tend to stress one rather than another strategy appropriate for a multicultural, non-Eurocentric, non-phallocentric world, it implies several different responses in architecture too. The category is too diverse to do justice to in such a short time. I will take up one strand, the strand that deals with Deleuze's concept of a minor literature. And this was a paper developed on what is a minor literature, what is a literature that does not become part of the mainstream. It only represents a small group of people. And given the fact that our culture today is just made up of small, independent groups of people, what does it mean to have a literature or an architecture for such a group? And here he comes up with three things. The first thing is the deterritorialization of language. This means that an outsider who is not a member of the dominant group uses that language and that thus displaces it. The second thing is politicization. It's a political act to use the language of another dominant culture. And the third thing is collective valuation of your statements. When you speak for the group. And so basically what Deleuze is saying is that when you belong to a marginal group, whatever statement you make, you are making collectively. You cannot make a statement just for yourself, because it's just by being marginal, you represent more than just yourself. It's also political. Whatever you say is going to have a political angle. You can't act autonomously. And so you speak for the entire group. So the inverse of this, which is the characteristics of a major architecture, are as follows. Territorialization of architecture, which means that everyone can build in the same way, which is what the international style talked about. An apolitical stance, which is an architecture that refuses to be politically engaged. And privatization, which is the signature artist expressing himself. This model of a minor architecture provides a political model for practice with a strategic end in mind. It's one type of cultural response to postmodernism, which is different from the aesthetic and philosophical responses. This brings my remarks to an end. All three responses we have considered, the aesthetics of Rossi and Venturi, the philosophies of Habermas and Derrida, and the cultural strategies of Deleuze, fall within the broader ambit of postmodernism. Each of these has a different relation of theory to practice, a different theory of practice, if you will. I'd also like to just end with a question that is often posed, which is, why is early postmodernism in architecture so important? Why in early postmodernism was architecture such a defining form? And architects were very, very involved in the 60s in debates on postmodernism. And I'd like to, you know, posit a possible answer, which is that postmodernism originated as a critique of positivism. Architecture was steeped in positivism because of its engineering and technical dimension, and this provided early postmodernism in architecture with an immediate scene of confrontation. A lot of things that came later in the arts were first debated in the areas of architecture because of its anti-positivist stand. Thank you.
Two questions, please.
I'm just really struck by something you said about deconstruction. I understood Greenbergian modernism, I'm moving now to painting.
Sorry.
Greenbergian modernism to be a general attitude which said you criticize a discipline from within. It was, I think he derived it from Kant, and I believe that is inappropriate, but nevertheless, that was the argument he used. Your comment about Derrida and that kind of, again, taking the terms of the environment and using the terms themselves to do the criticism seems to me to be exactly the same thing, at least formally. And I wondered about that, because that suggests then that there's an unfinished modernist project in deconstruction, which I doubt very much most people would agree with.
Right. Well, that I think the most difficult thing in this is that everything is a response to modernism and how you limit it in some ways. So when you say that deconstruction works with modernism, you know, I think you can say that it's an unfinished modernist project. So whether postmodernism and modernism, there's a rupture, whether it's continuous, where you limit it, I think these are different interpretations. But I think this is an interpretation that for me makes a certain amount of sense, where you work within a certain discipline, within the elements that have been developed in a certain field over a millennium, and you're able to actually work from within in many ways to do, yes.
Perhaps the real difference is the positivism, because in the modernist project that positivism is clear from Greenberg's side.
Can I venture an answer to this? What Habermas said was that Hegel and Marx took the wrong turn from Kant. You mentioned Kant earlier. What Habermas said was that Hegel and Marx took the wrong turn from Kant. What Habermas is doing, he's taking Kant's critical theory, but putting epistemology in a critical way. So in fact, both answers are right. There is a link with Kant, so there is a continuity. On the other hand, there's a break with the positivist. So it is in that sense post-positivist and modernist. So I guess both the answers are there within Habermas, of course. Yes.
Just very quickly, I was intrigued that in the last section, you didn't give an example of an architect for Deleuzian theory.
Yes, I couldn't find enough projects that have actually been built. These are very experimental. There are feminists. There are, you know, very small groups who are still working with the ideas, but have not actually come up with schemes that I could really show. They're fragments of thought, they're parts of symposiums, but they haven't been articulated into architecture.
What do you think of perhaps just to take up that question, which is very fascinating how you came to Deleuze at the end, and the idea of a minor literature which Deleuze and Guattari derived from Kafka's practice of being in that situation. You can't write in German, he's a Prague Jew, but you also can't not write in German. So you are in this impasse. And Deleuze says if you are in a Kafkaesque position, then you have the impasse already given to you as a burden. Otherwise, if you don't have that, he says, you have to create your own impasse. Therefore, you can't have a Deleuzian model. He had neither a school of acolytes like Derrida, nor models. In some ways,
right.
you have to invent
it. For development, but it's a little hard to know exactly how to develop especially in architecture, where signs are so ambiguous. If you have a sign which is clear, then it becomes very clear when you use it that...
An Australian cultural theorist called Megan Morris introduced this idea of the minor to us by talking about Claire Johnston's work. And she thought that she explained the theory of the minor, but said that it is slightly romantic. It is a theory for the production of avant-garde text, but there is an aspect of it that's useful, that is production in cramped spaces. And that might be, if you're not in an expansive Euro-American space of endless resources, or, we can see an end, but at least there is an illusion that it is endless. But in our part of the world where there is a sense of cramped spaces, it's kind of a really interesting set of constraints. It's a set of constraints rather than an avant-gardist
productivity.
I feel the more interesting aspects of what they say is certainly the idea that whatever you say is collective. I mean, you have a certain, you know, responsible role that gets...
But that collective is not that classic Marxist collective.
No, it's not that.
He says the minor writer, the people are not there. You know, it's like, it's not... my example is from cinema, the classical filmmakers, Eisenstein and Griffith, for them, from two extreme poles, the people are already there. They have only to be mobilized. But the minor writer, because of all the historical catastrophes cultures have lived through, you can't presume that the people as a category exist. So the artist has to invent not only herself, but also the people through acts of storytelling. Whether storytelling can apply to architecture, I don't
know. I thought it was a marvelous paper.
May I have the mouth?
The one thing you didn't tell us was where you stood.
Yes, I don't know. I don't have a position. I think I was worried about that too, that I would be asked to give a position. But it's very difficult to know what to believe in because you don't want to be in a value-free diversity. But I do believe that there is. You have to accept all these different positions, and you know maybe something draws you at certain times, but. I have felt drawn to all of these positions for various reasons, and that's a very, you know, unpolitical sort of politically incorrect thing to admit.
There are two things which enter my mind from your talk. One is that how do all these movements relate to reality of architecture in India? How many architects are practicing from such aesthetic points of view? And whether function has been destroyed, because the postmodern movement you described of Venturi, you talked about function being secondary. So can that exist in India? Does it exist? And is it being practiced? What is the position?
Well, the first position, I think, has been accepted totally in India. I mean, that stage of modernism is really a thing of the past. When people criticize Chandigarh, when they criticize Corbusier in India, when they criticize all the masters of world architecture in the Indian context and they say that it's irrelevant today. So we've certainly gone past that stage. They've certainly expanded what modernism and its restrictions were in that sense. But where the more critical dimensions, we haven't gotten to that. They're purely decorative, they're formalist, like almost like Frank Gehry, you might copy a certain style. But the concept doesn't exist as to what you're doing. And then the question is also whether, you know, you can get away with it, whether it's Frank Gehry can achieve what Eisenman can. Just because he might externally do the same things, it's very hard to tell whether you really need to go that deep down to be able to achieve these things in architecture.
Thank you very much, Avni. Andreas Husen will give his talk at 6:30. So we'll meet again here at 6:30. Thank you.